The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. Well, for most of today's show, I'd like to focus on what I hope you'll find is a fascinating story. Herbert W. Armstrong often talked about the way the Nazis went underground. Well, today I want to take a look at that underground, and I think you may be shocked to learn just how thoroughly ex-Nazis infiltrated the post-war West German government at just about every level. There's all kinds of really well-documented information about this. So we're going to look at that. We're going to ask, well, what does this mean? Well, we're probably not going to get time to ask, but I was hoping to ask, what does this mean for Germany today? But looking at the pages in front of me, I don't think we're going to get quite that far. But to start, I want to talk about, well, we're reaching the end of a calendar year where everyone writes up, you know, their year-end reviews and all of their forecasts for 2019. And Geopolitical Futures yesterday put out quite a lengthy one yesterday, and it made some really interesting points. So I just wanted to start today by bringing some of those points to you. And what they say in that forecast really does tie into what you could call our forecasting model here at the Trumpet. You know, our model is based on Bible prophecy, and that model that we've stuck to for years and years and years really, you know, it has several basic characteristics. The decline of the US and Britain, the rise of the kings of the East over in Asia, the rise of the king of the South of Iran in the Middle East, and the coming together of this 10-nation power in Europe. That's our basic forecast. And this 2019 forecast from Geopolitical Futures really ties in quite well to that. Like I said, the decline of the US, that's one of the key things that we watch. And they had some pretty startling quotes at the start of their paper. They write, "The United States, still the world's dominant power, has spread itself thin, and the power gap between it and its rivals has narrowed. Conventional wisdom is no longer conventional, and around the world there is a sense that everything, including US hegemony, is in question. The coming year, then, can best be described as a year on the edge, a transition between the post-Cold War era and a new era that is yet to be defined. It is the kind of year that will seem remarkable only in hindsight," they write, "a moment in time when pent-up forces and countless events take us past the point of no return. It will be a year of anxiety, suspicion, and fear of what the future holds as countries seek to delay the onset of crises they cannot avoid." So they're setting up for some dramatic events that they see in the future. A point of no return, they say, the world is reaching as these crises multiply. And that, you know, US hegemony, US leadership of the world is in question. Now, they talk about one of the major threats to the US being an economic recession. They write, "The US is in fact overdue for a recession. The Federal Reserve has issued a warning about historically high levels of corporate debt and the deteriorating quality of assets linked to non-financial business debt. Capital has been cheap for the past decade, and we have long maintained that the economic recovery since the 2008 financial crisis has been lackluster. The risk that a renewed economic crisis will either spark or accompany a U.S. recession can't be overlooked. While we can't pinpoint what will set off the recession, it doesn't make it any less real or threatening to the global economy." So the potential for economic recession. Moving on to the East, and I mentioned the rise of the kings of the East as being one of those key things that we watch for. They said China will continue to militarize islands in the South China Sea and build up naval and missile and air power capabilities, making it more difficult for outside powers to operate freely in those waters. Then they talked about how Japan will play a key role in trying to oppose China, and they'll become more militaristic to that end. They write that the government in Tokyo will redouble its efforts to lift restrictions on military development. Even if Prime Minister Shinzo Abe fails to push through the revision of Article 9, the constitutional clause outlawing war, this year Japan's broader remilitarization will continue apace, with the Japan Self-Defense Force boosting investment in new power protection capabilities. So Asia is going to keep militarizing, more military in China, more in Japan. And then on to Europe. In this section, well, they have a weekly podcast, and they talked about Europe in their Year in Review podcast a few days ago. And so I thought I'd play you. Here's some of what they said in that Year in Review podcast. This is Jacob Shapiro and Cole Alton talking about this. This is clip three.
If you had said to someone, you know, 10, well, let's say 11 years ago, so you got to get before the 2008 financial crisis. If you had said to someone, the European Union cannot survive in its current form, you would have been treated as a blasphemous heretic. You would have been laughed out of the room, and you would have been, not only would you have been laughed out of the room, you would have been treated as dangerous. You were talking about a world and an ideology that had long since gone. And now, I think it's fairly commonplace to say, yes, the European Union cannot survive in its current form. The real discussion now is, does it unravel completely, or is there an ability to reform it, to make it more responsive, more in the interest of its various member states? And that will define Europe in 2019.
So this is what's coming up for Europe over the next year, that the EU cannot survive in the way that it is. And in their article, they talked about how George Friedman, the founder of Geopolitical Futures, had been talking about this since 2005. And as you heard at the start there, well, to say that the EU as it is has got to have some big changes, well, that until recently has been considered heretical, extreme. But now it's changing. Now more and more people can see that the EU is heading for some big changes. Well, we've been talking about big changes coming to Europe for even longer. You know, the Bible gives us a clear outline of what's coming in Europe. And so we've said, based on those scriptures that talk about a 10-nation power rising up in Europe, so we've said, well, the EU is a major step in the direction of that fulfilled prophecy. To have this group of nations coming together and sharing some power, well, that's a step towards that 10-nation superpower that's prophesied, and a very important one. But then we've also said, well, look, the power in the Bible is made up of 10 nations, and they're much more closely unified than the European Union is right now. Right now, the European Union has just continually grown. It's now currently 28 nations. And so we've said for years, well, it's going to shrink down to 10, and that's going to require a major shakeup, and they're going to be much more united. And Mr. Armstrong said for years, that will probably take a crisis. I think it was in about 1985 he wrote about how an economic crisis could cause those nations to suddenly unite. And we saw that process beginning with the 2008 financial crisis. And that really did expose that, well, the EU can't survive the way that it is. It's too big, it's too unwieldy, and at the same time, it's too loose and disorganized to coordinate any kind of response to a major crisis. It needs to change. It needs to shrink down and become more unified, or it's just going to be completely fall apart. That's what people have been saying more and more in recent years. This article, they write, going back to this Geopolitical Futures forecast, for France and Germany, the only hope of retaining global relevance is through the European Union. Alone, they are weak. Together, they are much stronger. The EU is, after all, the world's second largest economy and could marshal a formidable military if France's fanciful vision for a European army ever comes to fruition. Germany lent support to this idea in November. So the EU together had the potential to be a major power. And they talk about how there are some big forces pushing the European Union apart. There's a lot of pressure on some of these smaller nations to split off. They talk about how hard it is to keep the bloc together when times are good, let alone when you have a financial crisis potentially hitting the United States. But then they note that France and Germany will do everything in their power to keep the EU together. France has no alternative, and for Germany the alternative is terrible, though so far it hasn't been willing or able to pay more than the minimum price for keeping the project alive. So they're going to do everything to keep this project together. So they'll be willing to contemplate some revolutionary changes. And this is what we've been saying has been coming for Europe as well. So You can start to see some of these Bible prophecies coming into clearer and clearer focus, and the Bible can give us some even more detailed forecasts for the year and more ahead than this 2019 one. I also thought they had a pretty interesting discussion about Iran in that podcast, which is another vital area we've been watching. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flory has been saying since the early 90s, watch for Iran to lead the Middle East. And now listen to what, and to become the king of the South, the king of this area. And so now listen to what these experts say talking about the rise of Iran.
Another strange thing happened, which is that Iran emerged as a potential regional power. Now, that's not so crazy because there have been times in history where Persia emerged, not just as a regional power, but as a global power. Persian Empire was one of the ancient world's largest and richest and in some ways most, I would say, advanced empires that the world ever saw. There has to be a very, very specific set of circumstances, though, for Persia to emerge as a major force. Persia is hemmed in. But first of all, Persia is basically a collection of mountains, right? And it's hemmed in by this geography that makes it very hard for it to project force over distance. So for a power in Persia to project power into the Middle East and all the way to the Mediterranean and become a globally significant power and not just sort of a regional influencer, you have to have tremendous weakness on the borders of what is today present Iran. And that's exactly what you had last year. And even though you had Iran struggling with a lot of domestic difficulties at home that were caused in part by, you know, longstanding U.S. economic warfare against this particular Iranian regime, you saw that Iran basically looked like it was close to connecting a string of allies to get it all the way to the Mediterranean. That changes things quite a bit. It changes the balance of power in the Middle East. That changes perhaps the relationship that foreign countries have with the world's biggest oil exporters, being between Iran, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia. You're talking about incredibly important sources of energy, less so these days for the United States, much more so for the Asian powers like Japan and China. As you say, what we expect going forward in 2019 is there will be a concerted effort by a number of powers to try and block Iran, to try and roll back the power that Iran has been able to amass for itself. And there will be powers that are going to try to support Iran because for whatever reason, it's important for them to have a bulwark to countries like Saudi Arabia or Israel or Turkey in the region. So that is why this is sort of, it's both a regional forecast, but it's much more of a global one because the Middle East, by virtue of where it is, you know, connected between a bunch of different regions on the sea lanes that it is, and also with such a powerful control over oil markets and the price of oil in general, sort of bleeds out into everything and everyone has to get involved.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a place where, you know, like we said, foreign powers have always had a presence.
So that's their discussion on Iran. And I think there's some really good points. I've thought about doing a whole chunk of a show on some of those aspects of Iranian geography. We kind of talk about this in international relations at Herbert W. Armstrong College, that geography of Iran that makes it very secure, but at the same time can make it harder to project power beyond its borders. But if it's able to do so, if somebody paves the way for it in Iraq, like the United States has done, and it's able to move towards the Mediterranean, well, it becomes a major force, a force to be reckoned with, like the Persian Empire was of old. And Iran has been becoming a major force, and now, you know, it's been pushing out, and they're talking about other nations getting together and starting to push back, which again, you know, that goes right back to that forecast we've been making about the King of the South, Iran rising to control the region. That's happened. And we have other prophecies that we talk about, like the Psalm 83 Alliance, that forecasts this alliance of Arab nations backed by Europe that works to push back against Iran. And that's exactly what they're saying to watch for in the year ahead. So that was their year in review, their year in review and their forecast, really. I thought it made some points that were worth sharing. If you want to get an overview of what the trumpet forecasts and our kind of forecast for world events, a good place to start for that is actually a booklet called "He Was Right." This booklet goes through an overview of just about everything Herbert W. Armstrong wrote, all of his major prophecies, and shows you how they're being fulfilled today, how world events are tying into this. And it breaks it down in that same way that I mentioned. Okay, the decline of US and Britain, the rise of the kings of the East, the rise of the king of the South, and the rise of this European power. it goes through region by region. It shows you exactly what Herbert W. Armstrong said and talks about what's happening. So it gives you a great foundation for our way of looking at the world. Just a good overview, a good way to get grounded in what the Bible says, and just proof upon proof upon proof that Mr. Armstrong was right, because he was writing about so many of these things that have already happened. You know, like Eastern European countries that were once behind the Iron Curtain, coming and joining modern Europe, just like the way we've seen within the European Union. And it's full of that, with, you know, dates of, well, this is what Mr. Armstrong said, this is how it happened. So it's a great way of seeing Bible prophecy fulfilled in world events, but it's also just a fantastic way of getting the overview of Bible prophecy and of world events, and just a background that you need to understand the world. So we're very happy to send you that book for free. You can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. You can read that online. You can order that. We'll ship it for free. It's a magazine, A4, or letter-sized booklet, full color. And it really is, like I said, a great place to get grounded in watching world events. And in the second half, we'll talk about one very specific way that Herbert W. Armstrong was proved right, in just a way that, I mean, it became pretty clear pretty soon that he was right on this. But then just with each passing year, we've seen more and more and more detailed proof that he was right on this subject. So we'll take a quick break, and then when we get back, we'll dig into that subject.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily. To those who followed the broadcasts and writings of Herbert W. Armstrong throughout his long ministry, and who still remember, world events today are an electrifying endorsement of the power of biblical revelation. Much of Mr. Armstrong's forecasting was proven accurate within his own lifetime, but since his death in 1986, events are proving him right all the more. For a comprehensive review of Mr. Armstrong's analysis, request our free booklet, He Was Right. He Was Right summarizes many of the Bible-based prophecies Mr. Armstrong proclaimed for more than 50 years. This booklet takes you back to the spiritual roots of the Philadelphia Church of God and the Trumpet magazine. To assemble the material in this booklet, our staff looked back through decades of old plain truth issues, looking for Mr. Armstrong's bold predictions. We then matched those prophetic statements with what actually happened or is now happening on the world scene. The result was amazing. The sheer number of prophetic statements made by Mr. Armstrong and his editorial team and their accuracy will astound you. The world may scoff, but Herbert Armstrong was right. Just how right is daily becoming apparent as we teeter on the brink of catastrophic global events that will lead to the greatest geopolitical intervention of all time, the return of Jesus Christ to this war-torn, war-weary earth. To order our free booklet, email your request to td@kpcg.fm. This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to The Trumpet Daily radio show. The first half, we just went over a bit of geopolitical futures forecast for the world in 2019. But today I want to talk about a forecast Herbert W. Armstrong made in 1945. He said this is while Europe lay in ruins after World War II, just, you know, hours really after the war ended, during the founding conference of the United Nations in May 1945, Herbert W. Armstrong gave a radio show, and on that show he said, "We don't understand German thoroughness. From the very start of World War II, they have considered the possibility of losing this second round as they did the first, and they have carefully, methodically planned in such eventuality the third round, World War III. Hitler has lost," he wrote. "The round of war in Europe is over, and the Nazis have now gone underground. In France and Norway, they learned how effectively an organized underground can hamper occupation and control of a country. Paris was liberated by the French underground and allied armies. Now a Nazi underground is methodically planned. They plan to come and win and to win on the third try. And this, you know, the Nazis and leaders going underground after World War II is something Herbert W. Armstrong talked about and wrote about a fair bit. Unfortunately, we don't have a recording of that 1945 radio broadcast. But here's a quick excerpt from a 1980 World Tomorrow broadcast where he talked along similar lines.
Ancient Babylon was the splendor of the world. And I tell you this thing, when it comes up again, my friends, it's only going to last a very, very short time. It's already being plotted and planned underground and undercover. It's coming up in Europe, my friends. And it's going to be a thing that will have carnal and material and national glory. And they're going to have great splendor. But all that splendor and all that glory is going to be dashed down and quickly. Because Christ is coming to do it.
So he's talking about it's going to have all of... It's going to be underground. It's undercover. Like I said, that this cropped up a lot in what he wrote. Now, look, we're, 60, 70 years after that? Well, did it happen? Is this real? Did the Nazis going into hiding, secret plans to evade detection? People going underground, going, you know, undercover, not being recognized. Did that happen? Well, the truth really could not be clearer. We've had more and more reports and a whole series of reports recent more over the last 10 years or so detailing secret Nazi plans the Nazis did in fact infiltrate key German parts of the government and then use that control to help keep other Nazis hidden. This is, you know, it's no conspiracy theory. It's something, as we see, and we go through and quote some of these sources, that's been reported time and time again by mainstream media. It's been the subject of government investigations, yet it's rarely gained any widespread attention in the West. And just about no one has been asking, well, what do these discoveries mean for modern Germany and for Germany's future? I mean, think about what was going on during World War II. By about spring 1943, it would have already been clear which way the wind was blowing. German armies were retreating before the Russians in Eastern Europe. The Allies had been defeated, or the Axis had been defeated in North Africa. German leaders, they still hoped they could win the war if they could defeat an Allied landing on the European mainland. But it was clear that it started becoming more and more clear, well, we need an insurance policy. Individuals were working out, well, how do we avoid going to jail or even being shot by Allied tribunals if we lose? More ambitiously, well, how could we hang on to some of our wealth and power? Party loyalists wondering, well, how can we set the stage for our cause to rise again? By the time 1944 sets in, when you have the failure of Germany to break the Allied advance with the Battle of the Bulge, it's becoming very clear the war is over. Or at least, you know, Germany's not going to win this thing. And so on August 10th of that year, government and SS representatives met with leading industrialists from Volkswagen, from the weapons manufacturer Krupp, the arms company Rheinmetall, several others, and there was a US intelligence document on this meeting published in 1996. And that US intelligence document, it says that SS Obergruppenführer Schied, he told the group that from now on, German industry must realize that the war cannot be won, and that it must take steps in preparation for a post-war commercial campaign. Each industrialist must make contacts and alliances with foreign firms, but this must be done individually and without attracting any suspicion. Moreover, the grounds would have to be laid on the financial level for borrowing considerable sums from foreign countries after the war. And it talked about transferring this document, transferring assets over to these companies, hiding Nazis within these companies, giving them employment in these companies as technical experts so they would avoid being arrested and rounded up. So clear evidence from meetings were taking place saying, well, how do we hide? How do we go underground before the war is over? And as I said, this wasn't published until 1996. So 10 years after Mr. Armstrong died, he never saw this US intelligence document talking about this meeting happening. here's what Mr. Flurry, Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry, he's drawn attention to this document several times because of its importance to understanding post-war Germany and you know, how it proves Mr. Armstrong was right in this. And here's what he said in a recent, I think it was last year, or maybe earlier this year, Key of David, talking about this document.
Notice this shocking, mind-shattering document that I want to read you here. And I'll just read you what we wrote in our book on Germany Conquers the Balkans. In 1996, a shocking World War II intelligence document was made public. The document detailing an August 1944 meeting between top German industrialists reveals a secret post-war plan to restore the Nazis to power. Several of Germany's elite industries were represented, including Messerschmitt and Volkswagen Works. These companies, the document asserts, were to prepare themselves to finance a Nazi party which would be forced to go underground. It would be forced to go underground because a lot of people after World War II were searching for Nazis. The article continues here. When the U.S. declassified this document, it received only sparse news coverage. Yet even more disturbing than the deep stupor of the press is the fact that the U.S. government did not make it public until 1996, over 50 years later. Now that's what Revelation 17 and verse 8 is talking about. And we have a copy of that document in our book, Germany Conquers the Balkans, and we'll offer that to you at the end of this program. But why was this document classified for 50 years? It's as if the U.S. and Britain, the British peoples of the world and others, were, well, somehow afraid to tell you what might be going on underground with Germany and their plans for the future. Now, this is just mind-staggering truth when you think about it. It's right there in our history books, and yet people just are very drowsy in the media and other places about what is really going on. This is a powerful underground work that is going on in Europe, and it's going to absolutely just about paralyze the rest of the world when they see what has really happened. Now you will see that very soon.
So some sobering statements about that document, and we'll look at that prophecy in Revelation chapter 17 in a little bit. But you've got this, you know, this document showing that people were getting together, industrialists were getting together, planning, well, how do we stay hidden? How do we go underground after the end of the war? And these aren't the only evidence of this happening that has emerged since the end of the war. You know, there were others. They could see the writing was on the wall, and they were preparing. Major General Reinhard Gehlen, he commanded the Wehrmacht's Foreign Army's East Military Intelligence Unit, part of the Abwehr, from 1942 to 1945. And so, you know, he had a clearer view than anyone else of Russia's advance and, you know, how Germany was going to lose. So he had all of a lot of his intelligence files printed on microfilm, stored in watertight containers, and hidden in the Alps. And then you're prepared for after the war. Meanwhile, you also started to get members within the Catholic Church were working to help Nazis escape, even before the war ended. In 1942, Monsignor Luigi Meloni, he contacted the Argentine ambassador. He asked about the willingness of the government of the Argentine Republic to apply its immigration law generously in order to encourage, at the opportune moment, European Catholic immigrants to seek the necessary land and capital in our country. So he's saying, well, there might be an opportune moment coming soon where there's going to be some European Catholics that want to come and settle over there. They want to get out of where they are. Would you be open to that? Would you help us do that? And Argentina was very happy to do that. But they began, And then they sent a representative, a German priest, traveled over to Argentina shortly afterwards. But you're looking at 1942. They're starting to set up plans to look at, and this ultimately was how a lot of people, German Nazis and members of Mussolini's government escaped after the war. It was through these contacts that the Vatican began setting up in 1992. So there are people making plans before the war ended. One day we shall come back. Until then, ebineto. I don't really know that language, but goodbye for now. Basically, the words of a military spokesman on Nazi radio, September 1st, 1944. This isn't the end. This is just goodbye for now. We're planning to come back. And so on May the 7th, when Germany surrendered unconditionally to the Allies, preparations had been made. And the Allies, while they quickly set up a new government, where in theory all the Nazis would be driven from power and we'd have a brand new democratic state within Germany, filled with new personnel. That was the plan, that was the theory. Okay, well, maybe some people from the old government that weren't involved in the Nazi war crimes, that weren't involved in the Holocaust, maybe they could help and stay on and get it set up. And that's what, for many years, people believed happened. Nothing could be further from the truth. And a lot of these different parts of the German government maintained their innocence for a long, long time and said, well, actually, our civil servants were generally opposed to the Nazis. They kind of, you know, they had to do their job. They had to feed their families. They did the bare minimum. But actually, they were working behind the scenes to slow things down and to oppose them. Then in October 2010, you started to get the floodgates opened on a whole series of revelations on what that post-war government was actually like, what that government set up in... after the war, the late 1940s, early 1950s, what it looked like, who worked for it. In 2005, the German Foreign Ministry, they produced a 900-page report on the Foreign Ministry's involvements in Nazi crimes. And it was kept secret. It took 5 years, and eventually Germany's left party was able to force its publication. This is the successor to the East German Communist Party that generally did a much better job of purging out Nazis from the government. I mean, there was a lot of bad things about the East German government, but they were generally a bit better at keeping Nazis out, and so they forced this document to be published in October 2010. And the Professor Eckhard Conze, he chaired the study. He told Spiegel after that came out, the Foreign Ministry wasn't just somehow involved in National Socialism or even a hotbed of resistance, as was long claimed. From day one, it functioned as an institution of the Nazi regime and backed its politics of violence at all times. After 1945, there was a high degree of staffing continuity within the ministry, and some of its diplomats were seriously tainted. The ministry contributed as an institution to the violent crimes of the Nazis, even including the murder of the Jews, he continued. In this sense, one can say that the Foreign Ministry was a criminal organization. So after the war, the Foreign Ministry turned around and said, there's no Nazis here. We oppose the Nazis. We didn't help out with any of the Holocaust. We didn't, we tried to slow Hitler down. And the response from the West was basically, well, okay, then you can stay in power. We'll just pretty much keep the same personnel in their jobs. We'll keep the same foreign ministry going. And then this comes out 2010, proving that was all lies, that those personnel were actually heavily implicated in the Nazi regime. And they covered it up. They went underground. And then it gets worse, because the foreign ministry was full of these Nazi-era diplomats. Well, you know, they were allowed to stay in their post, and then these compromised diplomats then went on to help fellow Nazis. You know, they put together legal teams to help fellow Nazis avoid prosecution for war crimes overseas and help cover up other Nazis. So after this came out from the foreign ministry, well, then the finance ministry opened up their books as well, because they'd often had similar arguments. Well, we weren't really involved, the finance ministry, in the, you know, we just kind of kept the day-to-day running, but we weren't involved in the Holocaust or anything like that. But then, you know, the books were opened up. They conducted a full investigation. And here's what the former finance minister, Pierre Steinbrück, said. The Reich's finance ministry literally plundered the assets of the Jews. It was systematic. He wrote, the Jews were stripped of savings, assets, anything with financial or material value. That study was chaired by Professor Hans-Peter Ullmann. And he said that at one point, 30% of the German government was financed by stolen Jewish assets. And writing on this report as it came out, the New York Times commented, plundering Jewish assets could not have been possible without an efficient civil service. So actually, yes, the finance ministry was also full of people helping to do this. Full of Nazis that were allowed in mostly just to stay in their posts after the war ended. Still there. Then in December 2011, the German government published a report into the prevalence of Nazis among government staff. It concluded that after the war ended, continuities in personnel among civil servants was relatively high. So lots of people from the Nazi government were just allowed to keep on in their jobs going into the post-war German government. They estimate, some of their experts estimated that 70% of government's personnel was simply allowed to keep working in their jobs after the war ended. Other figures say that that could be as high as 90%. So you're looking at 70 to 90% of the German government post-war being the same as it was under Adolf Hitler. Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong was right when he said that they've just gone underground. That Germany's not been denazified. At this point, there's no disputing that whatsoever. They were able just to keep their heads down and stay in government. Spiegel Online noted, none of this information is new. For years, the notion that partisans of the Nazi regime were able to manipulate themselves into the top levels of government in the young Federal Republic, and that former Nazi members set the tone in a country governed by the post-war constitution in the 1950s and 60s, has been a subject for historians. So historians have known about this. This is just, it's more detailed information, more statistical information. There's a lot of experts saying, well, yeah, we knew there were a lot of Nazis in the post-war government. But what these studies have shown us, and what we're really surprised at, is just how many. It's worse than we thought. That's kind of the consensus that you get reading some of these reports. This same set of papers, they revealed that 25 cabinet members, so high-level ministers in the post-war government, one president, one chancellor of post-war Germany were former members of the Nazi Party. There were, as a post-war minister of justice and a finance minister, that had both been part of Hitler's stormtroopers. So not just Nazi Party members, the stormtroopers, you know, these were the devout followers of Hitler from earlier days, behind Kristallnacht and some of these abuses that he committed on his way to coming to power. You know, that's not just someone that even cooperates with the Nazi government once they take over. That was helping the Nazis get into power in the first place. The historian Michael Wildt, it said, it will become clear that all government institutions, provided they exist at the time, were involved in the mass crimes of the Nazis. Ministries and government agencies have covered up, denied, and repressed their dark history, he says. Covered up, denied, and repressed. They put it underground. Just like Mr. Armstrong said. Spiegel wrote that the institutions that were newly formed under the post-war constitution, namely the police and intelligence service, were largely staffed with civil servants from the old criminal organizations. They wrote that hardly anyone in law enforcement was not tainted with a Nazi past. Just about all of the police. They write that Nazi dictatorship's helpers hid under the coattails of the domestic intelligence service in the early years of the Federal Republic. So everybody really that's in charge of looking for Nazis, looking for old Nazis, is full of old, like the, and arresting people for their crimes, like the police, and we'll get to the Justice Ministry in a minute. They're all staffed with old Nazis, and they help their friends get away. Next investigation was much more recent, 2016, and this was from the Justice Ministry. And it concluded that at one point, around three-quarters of Justice Ministry officials in post-war Germany were former Nazis. Three-quarters! So again, it's not just a handful crept in. The Financial Times called it a surprisingly high figure and much bigger than the researchers had expected. They wrote that 34 of the Justice Minister's leading judges and lawyers, they weren't just Nazi supporters, they were members of the Stormtroopers. The Telegraph, talking about this report when it came out, they wrote that the fascist old boys network closed ranks, enabling its members to shield each other from justice, the study found, helping to explain why so few Nazi criminals ever went to prison. They just went underground instead. Like I said, this is the ministry that's responsible for trying to find and convict ex-Nazis, and it itself was full of ex-Nazis. Germany's justice minister at the time that this study came out, Heiko Maas, he said that the Nazi-era lawyers went on to cover up old injustices rather than to uncover it, and thereby created new injustice. And these investigations are still ongoing. After that one was published, a month or so later, the Chancellery began an investigation, and that will be published in, or finished in 2020. It was a wide-ranging investigation, but it included the Chancellery, and that included several well-known Nazis that we know about already after the war. And so all of those details will be forthcoming in the next few years. But it's clear that just about all levels of the German government were filled with people that had supported the Nazis, worked for them, and they were just allowed to continue. It looked like a brand new government on the surface, brand new post-war government, but underground, it was mostly just the same organization. The same, you get a similar story when you start to look at other areas. So the Secret Service. This is one area you would surely think you'd have to make sure was free of Nazis. But no, like we mentioned Major General Reinhard Gehlen earlier. You know, we left him back in 1944 hiding intel in the Swiss Alps. He made sure that he surrendered to the Americans, and he basically offered them a deal. He came to them and said, look, I control the leading German intelligence unit focused on the Soviets. I've got all of my intelligence hidden away. I can tell you where it is. Set me free, and I can basically hand you a ready-made anti-Soviet espionage unit. I can give you my intel, we can resurrect my unit of the Abwehr, and I can help you spy on the Soviets. You know, you don't have much intel on the Soviets. You've been focused on fighting us. Well, we've got a whole lot of intelligence that we're sure you'll find very valuable. And incredibly, America accepted the deal. Gehlen was freed. He was then paid to rebuild his old organization, using much of his same staff from when he was working for the Abwehr. You know, the intelligence department of the Wehrmacht, of Hitler's army. He was then allowed pretty much a free hand to recruit from other ex-Nazis. He wasn't particularly picky. Ex-Gestapo, ex-SS, war criminals, Nazis who had participated directly in the Holocaust. They were all hired to work for his new Secret Service organization. According to one estimate, 10% working for Gehlen had worked for SS head Heinrich Himmler. 10%. And then in 1956, Gehlen's spy agency was formally transferred to official West German control, and it became the BND, which is to this day Germany's Secret Service Department. This is how Germany's Secret Service got started. And Gehlen remained the spymaster for years after. So you've got this ex-Nazi running Germany's Secret Service. I mean, is there a better example of exactly what Mr. Armstrong said? Of these people going underground? And then, unsurprisingly, for an organization full of Nazis, the BND, Germany's Secret Service, then went on to help Nazis on the run. In 2011, documents leaked to the Bild newspaper found that this organization had helped cover for Adolf Eichmann, one of the chief organizers of the Holocaust. They helped him hide. They recruited Klaus Barbie, the so-called Butcher of Lyon. He was a wanted war criminal. He'd been sentenced to death. He was on the loose, and they hired him as an agent in 1960 and even gave him bonuses and this kind of thing. Just this year, it was revealed that the BND employed the daughter of Heinrich Himmler, the so-called Princess of Nazism. She remained an ardent Nazi, a supporter of, and somebody who would help hide and cover for SS members right up until her old age. And she was hired by the BND, this German secret service. But the full extent of the BND's Nazi history appears to have been lost forever. They destroyed the files of about 250 of its early officials. You know, these were the files including those that had significant intelligence positions in the SS, the SD, which was the intelligence agency of the SS and the Nazi Party, or the Gestapo. So they got the files on all of their kind of most implicated Nazis and destroyed them. And that was according, those quotes came from an independent commission of historians looking into what had happened. Some of these people had been investigated for war crimes, but the BND destroyed all of those files, covering up their history, the role that they played in the BND. But most disturbing about this is when the cover-up took place. You know, this wasn't in the 50s or even the 60s. This was 2007. 2007, and the BND is still covering up its Nazi past, trying not to let this out. Now, what about the rest of the military? Well, initially after the war, Germany was banned from having an army. But it still formed one secretly, underground, exactly the way Mr. Armstrong said that they were going to do back in 1945. So in May 2014, the German intelligence agency, it published papers showing that ex-Nazis had put a secret army together beginning in 1949 that began to be operational. It could have fielded about 40,000 men and had about 2,000 officers. Underground and secret, but the German government knew about it, and even it seemed like the American government knew about it, but it was kept underground as far as the public and the world is concerned. The army kind of faded from the scenes once Germany founded its own, you know, more official army in the mid-1950s. But many of this secret army's top leaders, well, they went on to become important figures in Germany's military and Germany's military establishment. So Albert Schnez, he was a colonel during World War II, and he organized this army. He went on to become a lieutenant general in the Bundeswehr and inspector of the army. So a very senior position. He was very closely associated with the German defense minister, Franz Josef Strauss, and he was the one that raised up this army. Galen, the BND chief, this Nazi intelligence chief, well, he knew, and he met with Schnez. And he passed on information about the army to the German Chancellor Konrad Adenauer. The German government allowed this army to keep going. And they assigned Galen to monitor it and to work with them. It also indicates that Hans Speidel and Adolf Heusinger also supported the army. And Speidel, well, he went on to become NATO Supreme Commander of the Allied Army in Central Europe. So very senior position within the German military and within NATO. Heusinger was the first inspector general of the Bundeswehr. That's pretty much right at the top of the army, that position. There was another figure, Anton Grasser. He was a general in World War II under Hitler. He became an inspector general at the German Interior Ministry in the 1950s. And using this position, he made sure that the secret army could access the equipment and munitions of the German police tactical units in an emergency. So he worked for the Interior Ministry, and he made sure, well, this way the army, this secret army, could gain access to more weapons if there was an invasion. But those that looked at those 2014 papers, they also say there's just a lot that we don't know. There's almost no information in them about how or when this organization was wound down. None of the paperwork of this organization itself actually survived. Other documents show that the SS war hero, Otto Skorzeny, I should have looked up how to say that. Skorzeny, I think he was the one that helped rescue Mussolini from the Allies, or from the Italians But anyway, Otto Skorzeny, he set up a secret army as well. He kept in touch with Snetz. They coordinated. Skorzeny was working more, I think, around the Mediterranean, and Snetz in Germany. But apart from that, very little is known about Skorzeny's group. But you know, all we know for sure is that secret military units were set up, and that many of the leaders of these units went on to serve in very senior positions in the German military. And then you can look, I mean, it's become more of a scandal in recent years where so many German military bases are named after World War II era generals. And there was, again, a lot of continuity of staff, just like we saw in all of these other parts of the government. I'm starting to run out of time, so I've got to keep moving. But industry is another area. We talked about that meeting in 1944 with all of these different industrial leaders getting together. And, okay, well, how do we keep going after the decline of the Nazis? Well, industry worked. And so, you know, during the war, these industrialists, they worked hand in glove with the Nazis. Probably the most famous to do so is Alfred Krupp, who supported Hitler for years. And then his weapons manufacturer became, you know, almost a department of government making war material for the war. Representatives from Krupp were at that 1944 meeting where it was talked about this plan to go underground. And Krupp was so involved with the Nazis, he wasn't allowed to get away after the war. He was arrested. But then he was released from prison in 1951. And astoundingly, he was allowed to take control of his company, Friedrich Krupp AG, in 1953. When he died in 1967, he still had Hitler's Mein Kampf on his bedside table. So again, this unrepentant ex-Nazi just allowed back into his position, back into leading his company. Rheinmetall was at that meeting in 1944. They're back as a huge arms manufacturer. Busing, they became MAN, and then I think they merged with Rheinmetall, but they were at that meeting, still around. And they and Rheinmetall and ThyssenKrupp, they're making weapons again. ThyssenKrupp for many years didn't. Messerschmitt, that's now eventually over several name changes and mergers became the part of EADS that makes these military planes. The parent company of Airbus and that makes the Eurofighter. But these leading industrialists were allowed to continue as well. So it's beyond dispute that the Nazis went underground after the war ended, that they conspired to keep each other hidden, to avoid being punished for their crimes. So how did Herbert W. Armstrong know this? Well, there are some just really specific Bible prophecies that said that this was going to happen. Now, Herbert W. Armstrong long taught that modern Germany is biblical Assyria, and the book of Nahum is all about prophecy for Assyria. So it's all about prophecy for Germany. And there's a really interesting prophecy in Nahum chapter 3. Nahum chapter 3 in verse 17. Says, and I'll just read it from the New King James Version. It says, "Your commanders are like swarming locusts, and your generals like great grasshoppers, which camp in the hedges on a cold day. When the sun rises, they flee away, and the place where they are is not known." So the Jameson Fawcett Brown commentary talking about this verse, they write, "Cold deprives the locusts of the power of flight, so they alight in cold weather and at night. But when warmed by the sun, they soon flee away. So shall the Assyrian multitude suddenly disappear, not leaving a trace behind." So this is a picture of people suddenly disappearing from view. Now it says the Assyrian multitudes. I'll just point out that's not quite what the verse says here. It says that your commanders are like swarming locusts and your generals are like grasshoppers. You know, this is talking about the commanders and the generals. Those are the ones that... You know, one moment you see them and they're all there and very visible and evident. And then the sun rises, the sun shines, and boom, they're gone. And no one knows where. They've just disappeared. And it's the commanders and the generals, the leaders, that just disappear. Mr. Flurry talks about this in the Nahum booklet, if you want to read more on that particular verse and on the Nahum's prophecy for Germany, but just such a specific description of what we saw in Germany. You had all of these leaders on TV all the time in all these propaganda posters everywhere, and then the sun comes up and boom, they're all gone. They're all hidden from view, not obvious. And there's another key prophecy that forecasts this, Revelation chapter 17 and verse 8. It describes a beast, a symbol of a major world power, and it says it was and is not. You know, the beast exists and then it vanishes, and then only then to ascend out of the bottomless pit. So it comes from nowhere. It goes underground. It goes down into this bottomless pit and comes back up again. This power just goes underground. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry, he wrote in his booklet Prophesy Again that during World War II we saw the Hitler-Mussolini axis, but then it disappeared from the scene. It was not. And yet God says it is. The Axis powers lost the war, but as Mr. Armstrong preached time and time again, they just went underground into the bottomless pit. They're still there. They're just underground. And God says after this happens, they're going to ascend right back up. Revelation 17 and verse 10, it says that this power is ruled by several successive kings. They rise to power, they decline, they go underground, and then reemerge later. Revelation 17, it describes these kings as, in verse 9, as seven mountains with valleys in between. So not seven continuous kings. You have this power is there, there's a mountain, and then there's gaps, these valleys, where the power is underground. But this passage adds something vital. What goes underground will come back up again. And the underground part of these prophecies has been fulfilled precisely. And we're just seeing with each passing year more and more detail about how these men went underground. Just how this whole regime went underground. Well, really, that's about all I have time for. I'm planning on writing on more of this for the Trumpet print. We may well get into some more of this later, because there's just a whole lot of material here. Maybe I should have just reserved the whole show rather than talking about the year in review at the start. But if you'd like to know more on this subject, read our free book, Germany and the Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy. That's mostly by Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry. It goes into these prophecies and this history in great detail and will really help you understand what we're watching for in Europe and this underground power that much of the world doesn't see. So you can get that at our website, thetrumpet.com, and you can send any feedback, as usual, to td@kpcg.fm.